Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose-Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. For over two decades, I've been a reporter on health, food, and the environment, doing everything, talking about everything that influences our health. So it's so great to be with you every week here on Connect the Dots. Every week we talk to different experts, authors, advocates, activists, business people, scientists, and everyone that has anything to do with the different facets of our health and environment. We tend to think about personal health, and I've reported on personal health solutions for years, but we also need to think systemically. And on this show every week, we feature systemic solutions, and that's especially true today as well, where my guest is Judith D. Schwartz. She's the author of a new book called Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. She's a longtime journalist with a lot of history of writing terrific books and articles and all these different things. And she's actually going at our climate change issue, which I cover regularly on this program, from a very different and interesting angle. She says that by looking at restoring the soil, we can unmake the deserts, rethink climate change, bring back biodiversity, and restore nutrients to our food, all from cows. Well, it's kind of interesting because in Indian culture and tradition, cows were regarded as sacred. And when I at one point lived and studied in India, we found out it was because they were so incredibly practically useful and gave so much, and that's why Indians worshiped them. It wasn't just, you know, some kind of abstract spiritual faith kind of thing. It was really gratitude for all that cows give. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing more about this, and I'm delighted to welcome you to Connect the Dots, Judith Schwartz.
Thank you, Allison.
Great to have you here. So, you know, can you tell our readers a little bit about, you know, like, what brought you to write this book?
Ah, okay. Well, I've been writing about new economics, which led me to environmental economics, which led me to soil, which actually starts to make sense, if you pardon my saying so, connect the dots. I want to just clarify one thing. It's the book, it's not, like, the means of restoring soil is not only about cows, but cows, okay, why did I choose that title? One thing is that, you know, it's a book about soil. How are you going to write a book about soil that doesn't sound like a yawn? dirt has already been taken twice, so I had to do something. And then Cows Save the Planet, it's also a nod to holistic planned grazing, which, should I leap in and explain what that is?
Well, you know, let's not go there quite yet. Like, what I'd like to do is just kind of globally consider, you know, what drew you to this particular interest. And you say you were writing about business economics. What problems did you see, and what solutions were you looking to solve in that coverage? If that was kind of what led you to explore this area, you know, just to kind of get a sense of why we're here.
Sure. Okay. So when the economic downturn happened about in 2008, I was an underemployed journalist, freelance writer, and I started, you know, with time on my hands, I started asking questions like, what is money? You know, once you start asking that a question like that, it opens all sorts of things up. And I started looking at local economies. How does buying local spur the economy? How does the whole system work? How does money flow out of, say, rural areas like the one I live in Vermont, and towards money centers? What are the implications of this, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And I got very interested in what is called new economics, which is really exploring economics, an understanding of economics as something that should serve people and the planet, as opposed to what we have now, which seems to be, and alas, almost more so all the time, a system where people and the planet exist to serve this economy. So once you start looking at that, you look, I looked at the connections between economics and the environment,
mm-hmm.
and one effort to make the connection stronger, basically to slow money down and have it work for people, is something called slow money. I don't know if you've mm-hmm. had Woody Tash on the show.
We have. Yep, we indeed have. Mm-hmm.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I was just driving along here in rural Vermont, heard on a radio show, a very good radio show, Vermont Edition. I heard about this. I learned about slow money. I wrote about it. I went to their conference because it conveniently, this is in 2010, happened to be in Vermont. And at that conference, another Vermonter, sorry, everything keeps coming up Vermont, a fellow named Will Rapp, who's the founder of Gardner Supply, he mm-hmm. said something very interesting. He said that over time, much more CO2 has gone into the atmosphere from agricultural practices compared to the burning of fossil fuels. And, you know, something lit up in my head, just, wow, that's really interesting. All we hear about is fossil fuels.
Over time, meaning throughout the beginning of history, is that what we're talking about, over time?
We could, you know, there are lots of ways to measure it. We could say, man, even in the last 150 years, I think in the 1970s, it switched, and it became that more, like at this point, far more CO2 is going into the atmosphere from fossil fuel combustion. But even up till then, what we're doing to the land releases
a major
much more
contributor. Mm-hmm. It's a major contributor. Yeah, I hear that. I want to be clear about that because, you know, in our efforts to you know, slow and reduce fossil fuel use and move toward renewable energy, I don't want to kind of create confusion in people's minds about whether or not we need to do that. But what you're talking about is we have another additional untapped resource for either contributing to carbon emissions or reducing them, and that is through our management of the soil. So, you know, tell our listeners a little bit more about that.
Okay. Well, it's really timely because we've crossed the 400
yes.
parts per million threshold, which is...
Yeah, talk about that a little bit because that is, that's really, it's so to speak, the hottest news of the last 2 weeks, and it's going to be the hottest and probably, although it passed unnoticed, I'm sure, by many people, you know, I consider it the most significant news item, you know, that we've had, although other tragedies gain attention, and, of course, they're all horrible and sad and stuff like that. But this is really, in terms of a portent for human life and viability, I think it's a major, you know, kind of, we've passed a benchmark. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Okay, so... We passed, all right, so what we're talking about is the Keeling measure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's the measurement. It's been in, okay, there's one place where they gather data in Hawaii, and this has been done since 1958. So you can look at the graph and see the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere measured in parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
And it has steadily been going up.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's been said is that we need to keep it at around 350 parts per million to be able to manage life as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the organization 350.org took its name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've crossed... And I think it was in the pre-industrial times. It was about at 270 or something like that. I mean, forgive
mm-hmm.
me if my numbers aren't quite or dates aren't quite right. All right, so here we are. This is, of course, very distressing climate-wise. However, we're only looking at part of the picture. We're looking at this in a linear fashion, but if we start looking at the carbon cycle as a system.
Mm-hmm.
Not only can we understand more of how this happened, but there are ways that we can address this. And this, I think, is really important because we hear this news. We watch this line on the graph go up, up, up. We hear, you know, this is terrible. We have to slow down emissions. And, of course, we do. But at the same time, we're thinking, oh, my gosh. I mean, even if we stop today, it's not going to just drop. I mean, and also we've got all these fossil fuel companies that are saying, oh, no, we're having a great party here. Let's, you know, burn some more and all these things. And many concerned people are getting really full of despair.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would like to counter this, because when we look at where much of this legacy carbon, much of the carbon in the atmosphere came from, a lot came from the ground, and that's where it wants to be, because carbon in the soil, in the ground, it holds water, it lends fertility, it supports biodiversity, stops erosion, all these wonderful things.
How does it do that?
Okay. All right. So you've got healthy soil. What makes soil like soil as opposed to dirt, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. is soil organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Like, you know, if you go to a growing area and you pick up some soil and it feels it has a nice texture and it's almost like chocolate cake-like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's the soil organic matter which is giving it that wonderful texture, you know, that you just feel that there's life in there, and indeed there is. There's a great deal of life in there. So 58% of soil organic matter is carbon. Most of our agricultural soils, certainly commercially agricultural soils, are way depleted of carbon. That's the carbon that has gone up into the atmosphere. When there is tillage, when there's erosion, you know, a flood goes by, and because the soil isn't able to hold water, the topsoil just runs down and into water. You know, mm-hmm. rivers and lakes, and causes other problems there. And perhaps most importantly, because this is the easiest to resolve, when we take a harvest, when we harvest, let's say, corn, because so much of our agricultural land is corn, and just leave it bare, just leave it uncovered, as so often happens, all that time between seasons, that carbon is oxidizing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are so many ways to bring carbon back into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And basically,
what happens when the carbon oxidizes?
Then it's CO2. Oxidizing is it combines with oxygen
mm-hmm.
in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's where so much of our CO2 comes from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So a little kind of science thing is what process removes carbon dioxide
mm-hmm.
from the atmosphere. That's photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I didn't mean to get all science-y on you.
No, I think it's important, you know, because this is a science-y discussion. So.
Yeah. So
what else are we going to do? Okay.
So basically, what we want to do is promote photosynthesis. So this is really, really simple. Cover crops, okay? You've got land that would just be bare. If you put plants on them, then those plants are pulling carbon down from the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can really, and this is where you need restorative agricultural techniques, when you get land managers who really know how to farm or grow or do permaculture or whatever it is, then you start really getting plants with deeper roots that pull the soil, pull the carbon down and bring it deeper into the soil. And
mm-hmm.
I'll just leave you with one thing is that another way to look at it is that the flip side of our CO2 problem that we see in that iconic graph going up to 400 and beyond, the flip side of that is soil carbon depletion or
mm-hmm.
loss of soil function.
Mm-hmm.
And building soil and storing CO2 in the soil and drawing it down from the atmosphere, they're the same process. Okay, I might have just said all that too fast.
Well, what you're saying is if we treat the soil differently, we have a whole different resource for managing CO2 levels.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
exactly. And just to give a sense of it, just the estimates of how much soil carbon has been lost uh-huh. is like in the tens to hundreds of gigatons. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot. Even, and I've been actively in touch with people who are really working on this, even if we increase soil carbon slightly in the soils, we're making a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people that say if we can improve the soil in half of our, and I'm not sure if they're talking globally or in this country, because there are all kinds of different measures being done all the time, different estimates, but half our soils, half our lands, then we can bring the CO2 level down to pre-industrial levels,
so,
which is kind of extraordinary.
So you're saying that if we do what with half our land?
Raise the percentage of soil carbon. I know soil carbon isn't something that's entered our public discussions. Okay, I've been talking about agricultural lands, but I need to shift because the kind of land with the biggest potential to store carbon is grasslands, because
mm-hmm.
grasses go so deep into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, also, just to kind of put a perspective on this, that soil is already our biggest storehouse of carbon, that there's more carbon in our soils than there is in plant life, including trees,
mm-hmm.
and the atmosphere combined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this isn't like this is anything new. This isn't like a nifty geoengineering trick. This is like working with
nature and what it's designed to do.
Exactly, mm-hmm. because we've mm-hmm. been messing up the soil.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, we've messed up the soil and we've lost carbon to the atmosphere through the way we've treated the soil, but if we can take steps to reverse that tendency, then we can have better soil and also recapture some of that carbon back from the atmosphere down into the soil.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And what would be the ways that we could do that? I mean, and you're saying that some people are looking into this,
mm-hmm.
And they have said that we could even recover as high as 50%. Of course, that would be however much we recover is predicated on however much we do, obviously.
Right.
Are you talking to people like Alan Savory and people like that? Is that who you're referring to? Because I know this has been one of his themes for a while. He's a South African
Zimbabwean.
Thinker.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that whose work we're referring to? Just
exactly.
Just,
and mm-hmm. that's where the title comes from, Cows Save the Planet, because mm-hmm. his holistic plan grazing
mm-hmm.
model
mm-hmm.
uses livestock for
mm-hmm.
large-scale land restoration
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and in that process brings down carbon. And
mm-hmm.
they are focusing on the grasslands,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is grasslands represent a huge percentage of our global landscape. I mean, you know, in Africa, the savanna, the steppes, and North Europe and Asia, just it's a lot.
So in other words, what you're also implying here is that this is an initiative that could happen in more desert areas of the world. It's not necessarily something that's going to happen in the backyard of people listening to this necessarily, although maybe it could. So, you know, where would it be happening, and then what would be required, actually?
Okay. I was out west. I wanted to see some of this holistic plant grazing in action, so I went out to Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota to see this in operation. And living in the East Coast, I had no idea how, like, as one of the people out in North Dakota said, that the land here tells you that you will never have a tractor big enough. That it's the land, there are huge areas of land. And also last year we had that terrible drought.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that drought and alternating with flooding, which happened, I guess, the year before, and there have been some flooding. early this spring as well, out in the Great Plains and the Midwest, that's a symptom of desertification, mm-hmm. which is the loss of land function. So, I mean, it's not quite turning to desert, but it's formerly productive land that's losing its ability to sustain life and hold water.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that's land, the great ranches, the great grasslands of the West,
mm-hmm.
are areas of land that we can do this. But people do this in Vermont, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just that when you're going out west or to seasonal, okay, Alan Savory calls it brittle land.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so here in the East Coast, it's not a matter of how much rain there is. You know, like, okay, it's a seasonal dryness. And, like, take, for example, South Africa. You know, my husband's from South Africa, and so he moved from South Africa, where it was sunny, like, almost all the time, and then he moved to London, where it was raining almost all the time, and mm-hmm. yet those lands, they had the same amount of rainfall per year. It's the seasonality of it. Those are the lands that are most at risk of desertifying.
Which lands are those?
They're called highly brittle, or, you know, they're on the brittleness scale.
Okay, so, you know, it's not the amount of rainfall, it's the quality, but
the way it's distributed across the year.
Okay, so...
So the land...
Can you explain that a little bit? Let's just define, because I'm getting lost here, and I'm kind of a scientist.
Sorry.
So, you know, so you're saying that there's something called brittle lands, and those are at risk in terms of the kind of going toward a desert or, you know, going away from being able to hold a rich soil, the CO2 and all the rest of it. And so there's a category of land called brittle lands.
Yes.
And so what is a brittle land?
That is land that is dry much mm-hmm. of the year.
Okay, and so it could be in any kind of climate, from South Africa to London, and it could still, or
okay.
England, and it could still be brittle land.
I didn't clarify. I'm sorry. London and England is the opposite of brittle. That's
okay.
Non-brittle, because they have
okay.
moisture distributed
okay.
throughout the year.
I and, see. So
right.
in other words, it's brittle if there's a lot of rain and then dryness.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So what kind? So these are certain kinds of... you know, areas, and they could be at any longitude or latitude or something. It's not like they're equatorial necessarily or anything like that.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at the map of the world and you look at areas that are desertifying, and there
mm-hmm.
are a lot of areas desertifying,
mm-hmm.
then it's the brittle ones that are the ones that are in that process
mm-hmm.
or are at risk of that process.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the southwest of our country is in that
mm-hmm.
situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when those places go in that direction, it has an effect on planetary CO2 levels.
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it creates a kind of cycle, because when the land dries out, then a lot of things happen. You lose carbon, and then the land loses the ability to hold water.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you lose the ability to hold water, then when a rain comes, it doesn't soak in. So this is where Alan Savory, I'll describe his work a little bit more in a second.
Mm-hmm.
He says that all floods are man-made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's also linked to biodiversity, because most of our terrestrial species are in the soil. Like
mm-hmm.
95% of species are in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And when it dries out, When the soil dries out, it can't support that microscopic life, and
mm-hmm.
without the microscopic activity,
mm-hmm.
then it's harder to sustain a diversity of plants.
Mm-hmm.
You might get mm-hmm. a few plants that can make it, but you're losing the richness, and so the cycle continues.
Mm-hmm.
But what Alan Savory and others want to do is reverse that cycle, and that's where the livestock comes in, because they serve as one farmer up in Vermont, Abe Collins, says that they serve as biological accelerators. So they switch it. Should I explain how that works?
So you're saying they can, when you're in this kind of rut, they can bring about a change, and they can intervene in what otherwise just keeps going on and on toward dryness, depletion, and the loss of biodiversity. So how do they do that?
Okay, this is where Alan Savory comes in, and he was a game ranger in Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, and he loved wildlife, and he was lamenting the loss of the wonderful animals that he loved, and also observed that whenever they were preserving land and kept people and large animals off the land would deteriorate further.
Mm-hmm.
So it occurred to him that maybe the land needs the animals in the same way that the animals need the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that he observed the dynamics of grass-eating, grazing animals on the land, and saw that how they functioned in the wild, and then realized that, or, you know, hypothesized at that point, that by managing domestic grass-eating animals, herbivores, so that they will mimic the behavior, they will act upon the land as their wilder counterparts did or do, that they will help revive the land.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been working on this for, goodness, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And his work is finally starting to get traction. I don't know if you heard or saw, but he gave a TED talk in February, which has received about, you know, well over 1 million viewings, and people are beginning to discuss these ideas. And some people are very upset about this, and some people think this means that everyone has to meat or whatever. That's not what it's about. It's about having animals acting upon the landscape.
Yeah, I've heard his. I heard him. Oh, I guess about 7 years ago or more at a Deepak Chopra conference, and then since then as well. And I wondered about that because of course no one has to eat anything that, if they have the luxury of, you know, making a choice, they don't have to eat anything that they don't want to eat. But it also means that, you know, theoretically, since many people, you know, whether or not it's politically correct, many people do eat this stuff. And some people, you know, for some people who are not in an overly affluent life position, you know, it's valuable, perhaps. So it also seems that, you know, dairy could be produced and a range of things could be produced from having a whole lot of cows around. So I don't know if that's part of the whole picture here, but I can imagine why it would create that controversy. You know, how does that fit into it in terms of his vision? You know, leaving aside, you know, the political, you know, people's attachment to whatever their nutritional perspective might be, does it actually create more meat? There might be some poor countries where, you know, that would be really considered beneficial, you know, stepping outside of our own culture. What does it do in that regard?
Absolutely.
Actually, you know, as I ask this question, I realize that we're actually coming up to our break time. So let's hold that question.
Okay.
Listeners, you're going to have to stay with us. We'll discuss this in the second half of the show. I'm talking to Judith D. Schwartz about the soil and cows and how cows can help save the planet and her new book. And please stay with us at the second after the break for station identification. We'll be back with you and discuss more ramifications of this fascinating topic.
Well, well, well.
Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rosevi, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we've got a really interesting, deep, and important topic to discuss. We're talking about how cows can save the planet. I'm talking with Judith D. Schwartz. For those who missed the first half of the show, she's the author of Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. This is a book by Chelsea Green, one of my favorite publishers, actually. I just love all of the books that they offer with a deep ecological perspective. And what we discussed in the first half of the show, for those who missed it, is, you know, the dilemma that now we have passed what climatologists have long predicted as a turning point, a tipping point, for irreversible climate change. Fossil fuel use and the effects of industrialization have been a major contributor, but throughout time, another player long-term in our planetary ecology has been the soil. In the first half of the show, Judith Schwartz explained to us how the soil holds carbon dioxide, and this is what enables it also to hold water, plant life, different species, biodiversity, as well as being productive for growing plants and all of that. What's happened across time, across our planet, is that soils around the world have become depleted. They've become dried out. The CO2 has been released into the atmosphere, contributing to climate change. And at the same time, it also has contributed to a loss of water and moisture and a general heating up of the earth. We've been discussing some of these ideas are by a respected thinker named Alan Savory. As Judy mentioned in the first half of the show, you can look him up on a TED Talk. And so we're talking about how reversing that process could help save the planet. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots, Judy Schwartz. And listeners, if you missed the first half, please check it out in iTunes, in our archive, rather, and like the show on iTunes. So welcome back, Judy. As we were at the, you know, the end of the first part of the show, you were saying that, you know, there's some controversy. Some people, for reasons of, you know, food choice, you know, don't like the idea of cows, you know, kind of stepping up and performing the role they have done, throughout, human history, which is, you know, grazing the lands, and helping to create a better soil and thus a better climate for Earth. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, just kind of recap a little bit what cows do in this regard, and then we can go on from there and discuss some of the food ramifications of having more cows helping us out here.
Yeah, we were talking about that livestock can play a restorative role on grassland ecosystems, mm-hmm. grasslands that have lost function, are no longer as vibrant as they were. Mm-hmm. And Alan Savory does note that these are land ecosystems that aren't necessarily crop growing, that this is the most efficient way for these lands to produce food. Now,
efficient way is by having animals on those lands grazing. In other words, they wouldn't be the place we'd be growing the lettuce and the carrots and all those things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
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 They're not doing that. So we're not saying don't grow the carrots. We want cows. We're saying this land would be there growing barren, dry, and contributing to climate change. But if we put cows on it, that changes.
Right. We can reverse the process.
Mm-hmm.
So livestock, okay, it's important to note that, yes, it's true that land can be overgrazed, but mm-hmm. Savory's insight was that land can also be undergrazed, and therefore it stops functioning as well as it might. So the way that livestock, when managed correctly, and this is not a matter of just, hey, let's just toss some, you know, some cows out there and let them do their thing. You know, it's managed with utmost precision. Mm-hmm. And that's why the overall framework is called holistic management.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that cattle, they nibble the grasses down so that it exposes the growth points of it to sunlight. They trample, and in their trampling, they press seeds in to the soil, you know, so it make contact with the soil so that those seeds get into the soil profile, which enhances biodiversity. Also, the cattle trampling and walking on the grass presses dead grass down so that it can be in contact with the microbiology in there so that it can decay, and mm-hmm. that is a big part of the equation, and then that enriches the soil, it becomes soil organic matter. Also, their dunging and urinating is part of the nutrient cycle, and it creates ultimately composted manure and mm-hmm. and the nitrogen. So it's working with all the biological cycles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they need to be moved very rapidly, or I can't say rapidly because it would depend on what that particular land needs at a given time.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's high intensity grazing, but they move, the cattle are moved around so that the grasses don't get overeaten. You know, that's mm-hmm. what happens when you get overgrazing.
Mm-hmm.
But it stimulates all the biological processes.
Mm-hmm. So it's a way, there's a specific way of doing it to kind of enhance this effect.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And mm-hmm. I've had many ranchers tell me that when they started doing this, they found that they needed more cattle. And then this brings in that they needed more numbers in order to have this effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings in an economic component, which is that ranchers, land managers, can carry much more cattle on land when it is often four times as much land mm-hmm. managed holistically
mm-hmm.
so that they earn more. So
mm-hmm.
the ranches that I visited in the Northern Great Plains last spring,
mm-hmm.
they had been purchased by a company called Grasslands LLC.
Mm-hmm.
And this company is a triple bottom line enterprise, so that they want to make a profit, but not at the expense of the land. They want to improve the land. They want to, and improving the land, they want to improve the life of communities, many of which out in this region, they're losing people.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that was one of the themes that in every place that I stopped, they kept saying that all our bright young people are leaving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and where they used to have maybe one school in every town, they now only have one school that draws on students from miles around. So,
mm.
so this company is working with the Savory Institute to mm-hmm. manage this land. So they were custom grazing. Now, I had no idea what custom
mm-hmm.
grazing was. I just assumed cattle are on the land and, you know, that, but, and whoever owns the land would own the cattle. But apparently there are people that own cattle and they want their cattle to be on good land so that they have good nutrition and they produce healthy meat and healthy calves, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So cattle were on this land. They had
mm-hmm.
so, and then the people working for the grasslands were managing the land. Anyway, it was quite wonderful. I followed these people in Montana when they were herding on horseback, and it was
mm-hmm.
all very romantic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to watch them, you know, like, you know, just ride across these vast land, beautiful lands, and moving the cattle.
Mm-hmm.
Felt like going back in time. Of course,
mm-hmm.
I was in the pickup.
Mm-hmm.
Ron, the manager, asked me if I rode, and you know, I looked at him with what must have been horror, because
that's funny.
Not like that.
So let me ask then, you know, are these then consumed, these cattle? Are they, you know, then do people end up eating them? Is it that part of the cycle as well, typically, with this? Just to be clear, I'm not trying to trap
yes,
you, but I just want to be...
Yes, I think so. The truth is that I didn't really discuss that when I was out there, but I think so.
Mm-hmm.
But they're having very healthy lives, and a lot of the cows are producing calves, and I'm not sure how many of those then are used in dairy operations. I really, really don't know. But
mm-hmm.
I know that dairy farmers or people with ranches that raise dairy cattle also do this.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
there are, but a lot of animals can do this. Just as an example of you know, about the whole, like, you know, what happens to the animals. The same ranchers, the Goddards in Montana, Kathleen Goddard, who works together with her husband doing this, she told me about a previous ranch that they were on where someone had decided to rescue 800 Premarin horses. I don't know. Do you know what Premarin? Okay. Horses are raised for estrogen replacement therapy. And
oh, well, I thought Premarin was, in fact, the drug. I thought it was an odd coincidence that there was a horse of a similar name. So you were talking about Premarin, the hormone replacement thing.
Exactly.
That comes from horses. Uh-huh.
I mean, the word mare is pretty much in that,
right.
in that word. So
mm-hmm.
that is synthesized or, you know, extracted from the urine of pregnant mares.
Hmm.
So when the mares get pregnant, apparently the treatment of the horses is pretty harsh because it's more concentrated if they don't drink much, so they have thirsty horses. Anyway, it's hard. You know, their access to water is limited.
That's right, really interesting. Mm-hmm.
So they have these pregnant mares, and when the mares give birth to their foals, if they're female, they will then grow up to do the same thing. But if they have boys, geldings, well, mm-hmm. they're, you know, a byproduct of the process. So there
Amazing.
Were 800 geldings mm. that were going to be turned into horse meat.
Mm.
And someone learned about this and said, we've got to do something. They were brought down to Montana. Apparently it was quite an operation, brought from Canada to Montana. You know, the paperwork and the logistics, you can imagine. And then Kathleen holisticated with them. She managed these horses to manage the land.
Hmm.
And these particular horses, I think it was a couple of years, and she said that because there was a lot of draft horse in them, they were really, really good workhorses, and they were placed in other ranches.
So in other words, they were doing a similar function in some way. They're doing a similar function to what the cows do? Is that what we're saying here?
Absolutely. It's any
really?
Grazing animal. Sheep in South America, in the Patagonia area,
hmm.
I've heard people describe 50,000 sheep moving as one. You know, when you see sheep, they really move as one across the plain.
That's them.
So
mm-hmm.
all goats, all these different animals can be.
So
used.
It's kind of like more land devoted to grazing animals. And then if you have a drought-ridden area, in fact, it improves the ability to hold water. And what does that do on an atmospheric level?
Oh, wow, all sorts of things. Okay, well, when land is moist, it can support plants. So you have more of the photosynthesizing going on. And then also, bare land also absorbs heat. It,
mm-hmm.
So when you have plants on the ground, you've got a whole small water cycle happening. You've got those plants are transpiring and creating water vapor and kind of keeping it cool, like the same effect when you go into a forest.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is the shade, but part of it is that cool feeling is also the transpiration of the all the plants going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the antithesis. What you want is the antithesis of the hot plate effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that's what keeping the land moist does. And then in terms of droughts and floods, that what the goal is, we often focus on rainfall, mm-hmm. but the goal is, according to Alan Savory, you know, he's introduced the awareness of this to people, is that you want the rain that falls to be more effective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you could have a huge rain, and if the land can't take in the water, it just streams away.
Right, and then yeah, that's terrible. That's really an excellent point. Now, in order to make a substantive contribution to the fact that we've now kind of gone over the brink in terms of climate change, sadly, you know, how much land would need to be grazed to make a significant difference? And how much, you know, is available and is happening, you know, would be happening now in that regard? In other words, how much would need to happen and how far away are we from that?
Okay, well, a lot of land, maybe, I don't want to throw a number out because I don't have it at my fingertips, but all over the world people are doing holistic management.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other restorative agricultural processes that mm-hmm. can be applied on land that will have similar benefits, but depending on what the land is and what the circumstances are and what people's resources are,
mm-hmm.
they might be more appropriate. Okay, for example, in Australia there's a technique called pasture cropping, which mm-hmm. basically means putting crops in between grasses, between native grasses,
mm-hmm.
so that the land is never uncovered and the plants work synergistically and the carbon goes deeper into the soil and builds soil at deeper profiles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. There's a lot of experimenting going on in North Dakota, in the Burley County Soil Conservation District. They're doing great work with cover crops, again, using different combinations of cover crops that again, works synergistically, and each crop kind of pulls down different nutrients so that it can make the land more productive.
So they're building, the plants are being grown in a way that builds back the soil, it sounds
yes.
like.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And in terms of what's happening with the savory, with holistic plant grazing and holistic management, next month there's the first ever international conference in Boulder where everyone's going to be, one of the things to be discussed is this new effort, this new program, the Savory Hubs. So all around the world, in Sweden, in Turkey, South Africa, Patagonia, and the Western U.S., among others,
mm-hmm.
that building hubs so that people are working together so that larger areas of land are going to be under such management. And
mm-hmm.
see, where this gets to be really powerful is that you can start with kind of islands of restoration and
mm-hmm.
then build that to regions of restoration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when the land is functioning, then you're storing carbon, you know, so you're removing CO2, and you're building soil, you're making the land more productive, you're keeping the water cycle intact, or restoring the water cycle, all these things. And actually, I should probably mention methane, because a lot of people, as soon as I mention cows, oh, bad, methane. Okay, in functioning land, the methane cycle becomes into balance. That,
mm-hmm.
again, we're looking at things in a linear fashion, and often with cattle, it reflects the way that the land is managed. If you have cattle in feedlots and their wastes are collected in a lagoon, you have a big methane problem.
Mm-hmm.
If cattle are moving and the soil is functioning and there's a diversity of microorganisms in the soil, including organisms that consume methane,
mm-hmm.
Then there's not a methane problem. So
mm-hmm.
it all is a matter of how the land is managed, how the people managing it are working with the cycles.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, what we've, I mean, what's done in conventional agriculture, just to contrast that for a minute or two, because we're actually probably coming close to the show's end here, but what's kind of happening in conventional cycles is that, you know, we find a few ingredients, sort of beat those to death, sort of deplete the soil, you know, and whereas here you're kind of, when you say holisticate, you're recreating a holistic approach by bringing in diverse things that function together interactively to build and protect the soil and to protect biodiversity. Obviously, I mean, I would imagine, you know, that this is more costly than just sort of, at least in the short term. It's long term, the other thing is more costly. But in the short term, it's more costly to, you know, use these different crops, plant different things rather than do a huge monocrop, throw a lot of pesticide on it to make it work, and you know, and then if your soil is completely screwed up from, you know, over time by doing this, that's kind of, you know, too bad, somehow we have to deal with that later. Is it more costly in the short term to do this?
It might depend on where, what the condition the land is in at the moment, but I did talk to many, many farmers because I did spend some time visiting a series of farms in North Dakota, mm-hmm. And they told me that they're saving money. First of all, by having one person who has a ranch who also has a business, a wildlife viewing and hunting business on that land, mm-hmm. he said that because he's letting the livestock, he's basing their feeding on the grass, mm-hmm. he can last till March instead of before he has to bring in hay, because mm-hmm. it's like what they were doing is bringing the hay in for the animals and then bringing the manure out. Mm-hmm. He said that was very costly. He saved $50,000.
Interesting. So, in fact, even in a small system where this is being used, it becomes more cost-effective. Now, before we kind of come to the end of the show, which is coming up pretty quickly now, you know, is this something that the general public can get involved in any way, or is it just kind of an interesting development to give us hope, you know, in something some farmers are doing and like that? Can you give us a sense of that?
Yeah, I think we can all get involved. One thing is to mm-hmm. be aware of what the implications of the way that agriculture is produced.
Mm-hmm.
So making choices of where, what kind of food we get, what kind of systems those are, you know, that entails.
Okay, well, that is, for example, in terms of food choice, that's why I was asking earlier about the food, you know, avoiding conventional agriculture products, for example, you know, that's kind of been on the table for the, you know, after the Food Inc. and for better informed people for some time. But does this, what is there a way they can support this alternate choice or, you know, not quite yet kind of thing?
I think talking to people, talking to farmers. Here in Vermont, we just, the GMO late, I mean, it is connected, actually. We don't have time to discuss why it is connected, but our state house approved by a wide margin, a GMO labeling requirement, and that's
uh-huh.
because we were talking to our representatives. So I just think that, I think learning about permaculture, because that can be done on lots of, and really any land. There are a lot of movements.
But you know, yeah. I just want to, a lot of people don't have land.
Yeah,
so I'm just really
true.
Going for what you're saying here, and actually we're probably, I think
yeah.
we're going to have to wrap
sure.
it up at this point. But what you're saying is avoiding conventionally produced agriculture, voting for and you know, asking your legislators to support GMO labeling. These are some of the things that people that are not farmers or are not going to deeply educate themselves as you have done, you know, can do to kind of help shift agriculture in a more positive direction. Well,
yes.
And they can also, of course, read your book.
Oh, that, yes.
So, yeah, and that's just launching right now, right? It's like really this week pretty much,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes,
yeah.
It is. And
so tell our listeners where they can find it, because that's something else that you can do. You can read Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. I'm sure it's available on Amazon, and also you can go to the Chelsea Green website as well as to your website. Can you give our listeners your website?
It's judithdschwartz.com.
Great. Thank you. For more questions, tune in next week, listeners. To Connect the Dots, we'll be here Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern, as we always are. Thank you so much, Judy Schwartz, for being with us, telling us about this fascinating and complex topic. Like the show on iTunes, listeners, pass it along to your friends, and come back next week. It's great being with you. I'm Allison Rose Leafy.
Oh.